welcome back to Purple Row Radio. This edition is for Monday, May 2nd, 2011. My name is Greg Stanwood. I'm a staff writer at Purple Row, and I'm here along with my co-host, who is the, I don't have a good name this week, so I'll just call you the managing editor, Andrew Martin. Andrew, how are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing, Greg?
I'm all right. We are recording this really late on Sunday night, and Andrew was having some computer issues, so he had to call in through the phone, the classic phone mechanism for communication. So
I had to call in and ask the operator to connect me to Skype 113 and, excuse me, holding, connecting please, because I'm pretty sure that's the only phone technology that anyone uses anymore.
So that explains the audio quality there. We are going to talk with Jim McLennan of AZ Snake Pit later on, and suddenly Andrew's voice is going to sound a lot better because Skype was working at that point. But so let's get started here. We've had some key players struggling as of late, and I know we want to talk a little bit about two of them. So let's start off with Carlos Gonzalez, who had been in a pretty wicked offensive slump. He was like 0 for 24 or something like that at one point. And Andrew, why don't you pick up what he was able to accomplish this weekend?
Well, we saw him break the slump technically by getting a bunt single on Friday night. And for some reason, when he got that bunt single, the first thing going through my head was, he has a hit now. It's going to get into his head. He's going to work through this. You know, I've got a hit now. It's no longer an 0 for whatever. It's, you know, he has a hit now, so now it's time to start a new streak or whatever. And then he went on and had a, I believe it was a, at least a two-hit night, possibly three. I don't have my box score in front of me, but some pretty big hits. He sent him to both fields. He was looking real good Saturday night, and it was very exciting to see him, you know, hitting the baseball. It was very, very encouraging. And hopefully that's just, you know, the end of a nasty spell. Because, you know, these things happen to all kinds of players, you know, franchise centerpieces and, you know, bench players. Everyone goes through nasty spells like that. And, you know, this is just the moment where Carlos Gonzalez gets to learn to grow as a player, how to work through, you know, bad slumps and streaks of losing this. Well, not losing this, but that's not even a word. Just streaks of ill performance. And, you know, hopefully that's the end of that, and we can get back to seeing Carlos Gonzalez raking again.
Yeah, certainly would hope that there's no long-term issues there. I mean, there's always a tendency, if you will, to panic, and I know a lot of people were concerned that something might be wrong with him, but I think that really when you're this early in the season, there's all sorts of opportunities and ways for players to fall into bad habits or just fall out of whack. And, you know, with Gonzalez, it looked a little scarier because he wasn't even really making good contact with anything. He was swinging ahead of certain pitches and behind others, and it just seemed like everything was off, as opposed to, say, like Jose Lopez, who's also slumping but still, like, actually making contact with the ball regularly. But, yeah, it's...
With Lopez, I'm really just hoping with him that it's, you know... We'll keep this brief, but, I mean, we saw a handful of, you know, the batted balls he had over the weekend. I mean, I was able to hit one of the Pirates games over the weekend, and he's getting good contact on a lot of them. One of them was a, you know, one he laced up the middle and still got caught. He hit one to left field that was right at someone. He's making good contact on the ball, and he just has the worst case of hit him right at him-itis.
Yeah, he does. I was going to go look up his batting average for balls in play, but Fangraphs is being a little slow, so I might bring that up later, but I don't want to take that too long. Let's talk about Jimenez for a little bit. You know, everyone probably already knows the story anyway, but, you know, he's, ever since spring training, he's had an up and down, period with thumb injuries, and they just keep going and coming back and going and coming back, and, you know, we're just waiting for the news that he's finally healthy. And they said, you know, after his last start that, oh yeah, he's finally healthy, but unfortunately he didn't really show any command in today's start. He had some of the velocity back, but it seems that he's sort of lost some composure, and obviously I want to ask what you're thinking about where he's at right now.
Honestly, I have no idea where he's at, which is, it's just disturbing. Usually, I mean, you can look at the stats and find some glaring thing that says, you know, oh, he's walking too many guys, or he's not throwing enough strikes, or you know, just bad luck on balls in play. But it's more than that. I mean, just watching him pitch, I mean, he's barely cracking mid-90s, and we're used to seeing him hit 100, you know, at least a couple times to start.
Well,
and he's not...
Today's start, he hit 97 multiple times, didn't he?
So even if he was hitting that, I mean, that's where he's capping out. And it's good to see him starting to get some of that velocity back, but this is just a, you know, very slow build. And, I mean, yeah. We're going to have to be patient with him because, you know, you can't just, unless there's something more serious going on, because it's like you said, he's not commanding his pitches. For a guy who relies on just an overpowering fastball to set up to, you know, his supplementary pitches, and that's not to say that his secondary pitches aren't, he has a good changeup and a good slider, so it's not to say that he's, you know, completely out of options there, but he's just trying to get that fastball across the plate with a typical, you know, late break and just the nastiness we saw in 2010, and it's just not there. He's throwing hittable fastballs, and the Pirates just took advantage of him and put another four spot on him. And, I mean, there's good things to take out of Jimenez this season so far, but they're few and far between. I mean, his strikeout numbers are great. Even though he's, you know, getting hit a lot, he's getting a lot of strikeouts as well, and you got to thank his breaking stuff for that. It's still hard to hit, but he's also walking a lot of guys. He's falling behind in counts. His pitch counts are just through the roof. I mean, he got Rodgers up in, like, the second or third inning today, and he obviously didn't pitch until, I believe it was the fifth, but then Rodgers came in and got shelled as well. And, I mean, this is just someone on Beyond, I believe it was Dave Gerson on Beyond the Box Score, wrote an article about how Ubaldo Jimenez, the Rockies' worst starter. And, you know, Andrew Fisher went to Ubaldo's aid because, you know, the methodologies and the thoughts behind it were, you know, a little faulty. But right now, I mean, literally speaking, I know this wasn't exactly what Dave was going for on Beyond the Box Score, but we got to ask the question, is he, at this exact moment, never mind last season, never mind, you know, what projecting numbers say, but is he our worst starter right now? Right now, when Ubaldo goes out, and almost, and I barely watch the game today, and it's not to say that, oh, I don't watch the game. I mean, I usually have the game on in some form, whether it's on the radio or watching MLB Mobile or something like that. I had to turn it off because I just can't stand seeing Ubaldo Jimenez pitching this badly. I mean, he just looks like he doesn't know what he's doing right now, and it's disturbing, frankly. I try not to get too emotionally involved in them, but we get so excited about Ubaldo's 2010 say Colorado has their ace, and ace, yeah, he's awesome, he's untouchable. And I'm not saying he's gone. That'd be jumping to conclusions after 1 month, which was, you know, half injury played. But if we don't start seeing some pretty drastic improvements in May, I'm gonna, you know, be wearing a tinfoil hat for out of pure paranoia.
Well, yeah, I mean, we have obviously discussed him several times on the show. In some of our very earliest shows this year, we talked about how as those thumb injuries were starting to crop up, that there was no reason to panic. It was no reason to worry about his lower velocity back when he was pitching in 90s to start, because, you know, at that point, that's perfectly normal. I was encouraged by the velocity today. I agree it's not, you know, right where it should be, but at least it shows that he's not, like, dealing with an issue in terms of the power behind his arm. And it looked to me, at least today, that it's more like he's lost rather than he's actually physically incapable of making his pitches.
I'm just wondering if it's a comfort issue. Like, if there's something with his hand still, that even if it's healthy, if he just doesn't trust himself, like he's afraid to go, you know, full force Ubaldo because he's afraid his thumb might crack back open again or whatever the problem was specifically there. I mean, we know it's a torn cuticle, but I'm just wondering if he's afraid, not afraid in quite that literal of a sense, but he can't make himself, you know, push all the way anymore, at least for right now, because he's concerned about re-injuring himself. And I just hope it's something relatively small like that, that, you know, some side sessions will help with, that some, you know, work with Apodaca will help. All I can do, you know, we can do is wait and watch right now, because, you know, if we just try to do a statistical analysis of it, I mean, it looks like Ubaldo's broken. And I had a friend text me today and says, Ubaldo's the next Dontrell Willis? And that's a little early to say he's completely fallen off, especially after making, you know, three starts.
Right.
Four starts, actually. I forgot there was a I always forget about the Florida start. But, like I said, we got to wait to see what he does in May. Because, I mean, I'm hoping, and we're all hoping, we need him to have a strong rebound. But, you know, the good thing is that the strongest member of the rotation, Ubaldo Jimenez from 2010, has made four starts, and they've all been bad. And, you know, so far he's, you know, the most underperforming member of the rotation, yet the Rockies are still 8 games above 500. We should definitely keep that in mind there, that the rest of the rotation, I mean, even if it's not always flashy and glamorous, is getting the job done. And when they're not getting the job done, the bats are doing a decent job of backing them up. And when, you know, things are starting to look, you know, peak up, the bullpen has been absolute nails. I mean, we've seen very strong contributions from everyone in the bullpen, top to bottom. I mean, Clay Mortensen came up and made he relieved Rogers in that San Francisco game and pitched six innings of three-hit shutout ball. He's made some other good long relief appearances. Betancourt has been nailed. Matt Lidstrom, despite his sketch beginning to the season when opening day with that wild pitch unearned run scoring, he's been, well, actually it wasn't earned run because it was a wild pitch, but anyways, he has a sub-1 ERA. He's been very, very good. Houston Street, after his shaky game 2 start, has been effectively nailed. He's been a very good reliever. Belisle's been a bit shakier, but I mean, when Matt Belisle being shaky is the worst of your problems in your bullpen, we're in a good place right now. I mean, we're not complaining about Franklin Morales. I think we are in a good spot at the moment.
Yeah, I had mentioned before we started recording that I wanted to bring up the bullpen today, so it's perfect that we headed in that direction. I used to always joke that we brought up the bullpen too much, especially during the off season, because it's one of those areas of the team that fluctuates so much that even at any point during the year, it looks completely different than it did a month ago or 2 months ago or so forth. So it always would kind of be, spoken about too much or taking up too much of our time. But when we've been talking about, which players have been hot and cold at the beginning of each of these shows recently, we really haven't brought up the relief enough and haven't given their due credit. So I definitely want to take the opportunity to really explain how significant of an impact they've had on keeping us in those games. Because, you know, we have not been completely outslugging our opposition. A lot of the games we've been winning have been close, and you know, how many wins do we have now? 17?
I believe so. Yeah. I don't have the standings in front of me, but I believe it's 17-9 right now.
Well, 11 of those 17 runs were saves by either Lindstrom or Street. So, you need players like that who are going to put the foot down and win those games, ensure that you win those games, because you know, I've been saying so far this season that anything that the team has been doing, we still are showing our flaws, especially as an offensive team. But unlike last season, where it seemed like the team was trying to like pound their way through their struggles and just like smash into a wall until it broke down, this time they're accepting their strengths instead of just trying to break through their flaws. They're playing to their strengths more so. And when you have parts of your team that can pick up maybe some slow offense, and if you happen to be ahead by one or two runs, still be able to pound out the win regardless, that's a very important thing for any winning team to have.
No, that's absolutely correct. And this isn't to say there's no reason for concern. I'm incredibly concerned. I mean, up until, Saturday night, I was incredibly concerned about Carlos Gonzalez. Tulowitzki's going through a bit of a dry spell at the exact moment. I'm convinced he'll pull out of it, but, I mean, there's other things. Ian Stewart got sent down, and third base is still a big question mark as far as offensive production goes. Will the remainders of the rotation be able to hold out? And just things like that. There's plenty of reason for concern, but at the same time, we should also give the team some credit, because even though there's a lot of reasons for concern, we're on top of the National League West. We are still the front runners. Let's remember that. I mean, the team was built with depth for a reason. And, you know, nobody likes to see the depth having to be flexed this early in the season. But, you know, I guess I'd rather just, the fact that we have it, I mean, it doesn't matter if it's April or if it's August. The fact is the depth is there for a reason and it's doing its job. So, I mean, let's hope that this is the end of having to, bring up AAA guys to fill in the gaps, but I mean, hats off to the AAA guys as they've been getting the job done when we needed them to get the job done.
Sure. And, basically, leading back to just what I was saying before, it's nice to see that the team just seems to have a different attitude about their struggles, because last year they were dejected when they were not playing to their best, and now they're still saying, you know what? We can still win the game anyway. So that's an important attitude to have for any winning team, I think.
Absolutely. You pretty much hit it on the head. I mean, the team definitely looks like a different organization than it did last year. You're absolutely correct. Just from the small interviews you've seen with the players saying that they are just approaching it, taking it game by game, and just doing their best every time and not thinking too hard about what's coming up and not thinking too hard about the things that are going wrong and just working on doing their best for the things that they do best.
All right, so with that, I think I'm going to go ahead and go into the interview with Jim McLennan, and we will be back after that. All right. All right, everyone, we're on the line with Jim McLennan of AZ Snake Pit, which is the SB Nation Arizona Diamondbacks blog. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, always a pleasure.
As long as I've, you know, been following baseball, my dad always tells me, and I always bring up my dad in these podcasts, because, I mean, me and him, I mean, we have the typical father-son relationship. You talk about baseball, that's how things work. He always says, if you beat the Diamondbacks, you're going to do all right in your season. He always likes to point out that every season where we fall on our faces because we don't beat the Diamondbacks, even when it's not meant to be the Diamondbacks suck and we have to beat them. By 2007, if you beat the Diamondbacks, you're going to the World Series. And we beat the Diamondbacks and went to the World Series. He likes to put the Diamondbacks up on the team to beat within the division because we know that it's, for some reason, that's our barometer. It always seems to be something with playing Arizona that are just the toughest series. Even if Arizona's in the middle of a deep rebuild and the Rockies are in their full fighting force, it's always just a rip-and-tear struggle to try to get past the Arizona Diamondbacks. How do you guys perceive it when you come into Rockies series? Is it anything even close to that, or is it just, you know, another divisional series?
Well, I think there's a certain similarity in outlook between the Diamondbacks and the Rockies, and that they're both fairly, you know, new teams. So we kind of see each other as almost expansion siblings in that term. And we're both fairly, you know, fairly small market teams. We don't have a great deal of history. We don't have a great deal of money either. So in terms of approaches, it's kind of, we kind of look at the Rockies as another example of, you know, as a teams of a similar kind of history and similar kind of era. So there's definitely a rivalry there in terms of when the contests come up between the two teams. Obviously, at the moment, the Rockies are doing rather better and have been for the past couple of seasons than the Diamondbacks have. But it's definitely always a challenge. I think Coors and Chase also have some similarities in that they're both very hitter friendly. Even after the Humidor was introduced, Coors still seems to be capable of producing a good few number of runs on its day, and Chase certainly has developed in a similar kind of way. So both teams are also young as well. I think the teams have a lot in common, and that always makes the contests between them intriguing ones.
It makes me laugh when, because you mentioned, we know, because we follow the teams very closely and intimately, but that Chase Field is a hitter's park. There's a lot of hitter aspects going on there, and there's a lot of the similar issues to Colorado, what with, you know, a drier climate and balls drying out and stuff like that. And we've heard, mumblings and grumblings about Arizona wanting their own humidor. Is there much to that?
Well, there's something I think was discussed during the off season. I mean, we kind of started looking into the possibilities of perhaps trying to equalize the environment at Chase, because it's the second highest ballpark in the majors, and it also has, you know, definitely, as you say, a lot less humidity, which means that the ball definitely does travel and carry further there. But that seems to have gone on the back burner. I think I saw a study over the winter which suggested that if they did have a humidor like the one at Coors, that home runs could drop by as much as 40%, which would be a tremendous adjustment in the environment. So at this point, I don't think there's any real chance of a humidor being introduced in Phoenix in the near future.
Well, it's a good discussion point anyhow. I like I said, I laugh at it because when Curt Schilling and Randy Johnson were obviously the dominant duo down in Arizona, especially during the World Series run, it gave the Diamondbacks the reputation of being strong pitcher environment, and it's almost mislaid, which makes Johnson and Schilling that much more impressive because we know that Chase is a hitter's environment, yet it's perceived as a pitcher's environment because of, you know, very low offensive numbers for the visiting team because of how good the pitching was then. So that reputation's carried on, and as far as I can see, is in terms of kind of ranking hitters. I mean, for the people who don't look too closely into it, are going to go, oh, it's a pitcher's park. These guys are obviously much, much better than they may or may not be. I figure it's only it can only be a positive for at least you're hitting anyhow. So did you have anything to throw in here, Greg, or should we just dive into the team as it is?
My first question was going to be about Steven Drew, if you want to head in that direction.
Go right ahead. Steven Drew's a good start.
Yeah, this is going to be our second series playing the Diamondbacks. We had the opening series, which we split, I believe, and then the third game was rained out. And during that period, Steven Drew was on the roster but not playing due to injury. From what I can tell, he has come around quite nicely, and I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on him, Jim, in terms of how he has been playing for your team so far.
Well, over the past few years, Drew has been certainly one of the most underrated players at the position. I mean, obviously, Colorado has their own shortstop, I believe. I've heard mention of him down the game, shall we say. But Steven Drew is just one of the players who very, very quiet, very understated. You very rarely get any kind of reaction from him. Even the other day when he had a first inning grand slam against the Cubs, his lack of reaction to that was almost more entertaining than any actual reaction would have been. And that's the way that he is. He just completely flies under the radar as far as everything goes. But over the past few years, he's definitely been one of the most productive and steady and reliable offensive shortstops in the National League. Obviously helped a little bit by playing at Chase, but just generally, he's delivered a lot of home runs. He's delivered a good batting average, and he's very solid defensively as well. He's definitely one of the more underrated shortstops, I would say, generally. And he's also very good start this year, which is obviously helps to stand out a little bit when you're hitting over 300, 320 at the beginning of the year.
Now, given what we saw over the Diamondbacks offseason and, parts of last season, trading away guys like Danny Heron, that Justin Upton was possibly brought up on the block, and obviously that didn't go through, but is Steven Drew of any risk of losing his job, or not so much losing his job, but getting moved to another club as kind of part of a continued rebuild, or do you think he'll be the kind of guy who sticks around with the club for when things start to peak back up again?
Well, that's a very interesting question. There's no immediate replacement, obviously, present in the farm system at the moment. And it's also the case that Steven Drew is a Scott Boras client who tends to be keen on his clients getting the big payday come free agency, which will be, I think, the end of next year. I think he's under contract through the end of 2012. At that point, he's going to become a free agent. And if his production continues in the way it has been, for the past two or three seasons or so, then he's definitely going to be in line for a very large payday from somebody. Whether that's going to be the Diamondbacks or whether it's going to be one of the other teams is a very one of the thorny questions. It really probably depends on whether the team, when the team thinks they will have the window to compete, as Drew is going to be pretty much at the peak of his career at that point. And the question of how much you want to pay for a player who will probably, if he gets a 5 or 6 year contract, he's probably going to be beginning to decline, the latter chunk of that. So, it's not something that generally that the Diamondbacks have done is pay for players once they've reached free agency. So if they did extend Drew and sign him to a new contract, that would be a bit of a break for the team, definitely.
So speaking of other young players, you mentioned young players as one of the similarities between the two teams. Ryan Roberts signed with the Diamondbacks back in 2008, and right now is absolutely crushing the baseball at the rate of a .311 average, a .408 on-base percentage, a .607 slugging. He's hit 5 home runs, 15 ribs, and stolen 3 bags. Because we didn't see him as a mainstay of the lineup last year, or since he's been to the Diamondbacks, really. We've seen him come up and do things. But what's the story with Ryan Roberts? Is he just finally blossoming into the hitter everyone knew he could be, or is this something unexpected, or how do you rate Roberts so far?
Well, it's certainly something very unexpected as far as the Diamondbacks are concerned. He wasn't even really supposed to be on the roster. He had a very good 2009 season. I think from what he said himself, he came to spring training in 2010 with a bit of a sense of entitlement, thinking that, oh, yeah, he just had to kind of sleepwalk his way through spring training and get onto the roster. And the end result was he didn't make the opening day roster and spent most of the year down in the minor leagues. Now, he suddenly came into spring training this year with a whole new attitude and really ripped the ball incredibly hard and played very well and really played his way onto the roster when it turned out that Jeff Bloom, the veteran infielder, was not going to be available for opening day and is still out. That was what gave Roberts his opening, and all credit to him. He's taken that opportunity with both hands, and he's made his way from being a fringe player, unlikely to make the roster, onto that roster, and now he's kind of almost an everyday player. It's very difficult to keep a player who's hitting those kind of numbers out of the everyday lineup.
Do you have Ryan Roberts playing over Kelly Johnson at second base, or are you finding different ways to try and get that production into the lineup?
Yeah, there's the advantage of Roberts is that he has a fair amount of flexibility. He can play second base, he can play third base as well, so he'll be spelling Melvin Mora there. And he also gives us a left-handed option in right field, replacing Gerardo Parra. So there's a fair amount of flexibility there, which does make it a little bit easier to get him into the lineup. I would say third base is probably his strongest position. Kelly Johnson is very definitely the everyday starting second baseman, but Roberts has some flexibility, and that definitely helps out as far as lineup construction is concerned.
So this is kind of a personal note here, but Russell Branyan joined the Diamondbacks this offseason, and I just have this bizarre man crush on Russell Branyan, Russell the Muscle. As much as I want him to go 0 for the Rockies whenever he sees us, I also hope for, like an 8-run lead going into the 7th inning or something like that, and with 2 outs and nobody on, Branyan just hits one that, leaves the atmosphere. he's obviously not a long-term option for, pretty much anyone anymore. We saw the Mariners pick him up, and he had some success up there, but he's clearly not with them anymore. Given Justin Smoke and all that, but how do you see Russell Branyan's season going with the Diamondbacks? Do you see him as a full-time option, a platoon option, a bench guy who's just performing right now and getting more starts? What's the rundown on Branyan?
Well, it seems a little bit strange when the Diamondbacks signed Branyan, because they already had a couple of left-handed first base prospects at the time. They had Juan Miranda, a prospect that they traded for the Yankees for, and they also already had Brandon Allen there, who was another left-handed young first baseman. So with those two already present and available to the team, it seems a little bit strange to see Branyan brought on board. I mean, the vague thinking is possibly that they're hoping to get some mid-season value for him, boost his trade value, and then flip him at the deadline to a contender or something along those lines. But again, he's another player who played very well during the spring, during the preseason, and as a result of that, kind of came up with an expanded role. The plan going in, officially expressed, was that Juan Miranda was going to be getting most of the starts at first base, but it seems to be more that Branyan is definitely getting his good share of starts there. There's no arguing his numbers. I think over the past few years, in terms of at bats per home runs, I think Branyan is trailing only Albert Pujols. So when healthy, there's no doubt he can absolutely crush the ball. Though we haven't really seen that much in Arizona. I think he only has one home run today. So we're still waiting to see those majestic homers leaving the atmosphere. But I think it's very much as a performance-based scenario that we have at first base. If you're continuing to hit, if you're continuing to get hits, then you'll get the playing time. If you're not, then, there's plenty of other people that can play the position for Arizona.
You had mentioned Melvin Mora earlier when we were talking about Ryan Roberts. Mora, of course, spent 2010 with the Rockies. I'm sure some of our listeners would be interested in hearing your impressions of Mora so far and what he brings to your team.
Well, I could probably kind of sum up what he brings to the team in a couple of words, but they wouldn't be necessarily broadcastable. He's meh. I think it's probably pretty much the reaction of most Diamondbacks fans to him. I mean, it's we were used to seeing Mark Reynolds playing over at third base, and he's certainly hit more than his share of majestic homers. Now Reynolds has certainly been struggling with the Orioles the start of the season so far. So, it's kind of like a warm body over at third base, more from what we've seen.
Mm-hmm.
There's not really much in the sense of attachment. It's kind of clear that similarly, he's brought in for his veteran presence to a good degree and to kind of show the younger players the, you know, the rights, you know, the Kirk Gibson approved way to play the game, I think is a large part of why he's on the team. And it's, you know, his production so far has been, you know, it's okay, nothing special. You know, I haven't really seen, you know, any of the majestic, Mark Reynolds fat burger home runs, as we call them. It's an
interesting
stand in left field, but you know, he's been decent enough, I suppose.
You mentioned Kirk Gibson. This is his first full season as a manager with the Diamondbacks. He was obviously hired on to replace A.J. Hinch last season. Well, I mean, I know these are kind of, you know, general questions right here, but we've what are your thoughts on Gibson? We've seen him being somewhat vociferous from the dugout already earlier in the season, calling at umps based on balls and strikes and so on and so forth. Do we expect to see more fiery Kirk Gibson or, give me some impressions on him. I know very little about him as a coach or a manager.
Well, I think he's definitely old school would probably be the phrase that would sum him up best. I think he's definitely changed the culture of the clubhouse. Like players are now no longer allowed to have out their iPads or their cell phones in the time immediately before a game, things like that. And he definitely knows how he wants his players to play the game. And in spring training, he had them working drilling on pickoff moves and base running and things like that. It was quite interesting to go over to the new spring training facility at Talking Stick and just see the players just going through repetition and repetition and repetition, just so that it becomes muscle memory takes over and it becomes second nature to them. But he's very definitely got his ideas of how the game should be played, and he's you're either on board with that or you're not going to be on the team for very long, I think.
So let's move on to pitching here. The pitching rotation is at the moment a bit suspect, as we have no one in the starting rotation with an ERA under 4. However, the fielding independent numbers tell a bit of a different story. We see Ian Kennedy and Daniel Hudson both being very positive pitchers for the Diamondbacks. And let's see, Armando Galarraga being a very worrisome mark in the middle of the rotation there. Joe Saunders and Barry Enright aren't necessarily impressing either at the moment. Then again, it's early too. We know that some of these guys are, at least somewhat better than their numbers would suggest right now, and some of them may have some regression to look forward to. Really, when it comes down to the pitching staff, I mean, the worst we're seeing is Armando Galarraga and Aaron Heilman. Are both of them? We know that Heilman has been throwing bullpen sessions and stuff. Do you think he is a lock to be coming right back? And do we think Galarraga has a guaranteed spot in the rotation for much longer?
Well, I think Galarraga is probably going to be more or less settled in there simply because he can't be sent down. I think that we're still waiting for Zach Duke. He's the other member of the rotation who didn't get in there at the start of the year. So we're looking to try and get him back. And when he returns, Barry Enright is probably going to be the guy that gets sent down simply because he still has minor league options. He may not necessarily be the worst pitcher in the rotation, but he does have the ability to be sent to the minors without being exposed to waivers. So it would seem that he's probably on the shakiest of ice. But the problem generally with the Diamondbacks has simply been the number of home runs that the starting pitchers have given up so far. In five starts, Galarraga has given up 11 home runs so far, which is an insane kind of number. Three last night represented pretty much the bulk of the Cubs scoring. And he's the same problem applies more or less to Saunders and to Enright as well. They're both very fly ball oriented pitchers playing in a hitter friendly park, and the ball has definitely been zipping out of the stadiums that they've been pitching in as well. That's really been the main problem, and that's why I think the fielding independent stats tell perhaps a little bit of a different story. Their home run fly ball ratio has been pretty much through the roof, and that largely explains why the ERAs are so high for those three. Hudson and Kennedy are sitting up and down.
I'll just go real quick. Galarraga is at a 27.5% home run for fly ball to further emphasize what Jim was saying. There's no way those numbers are going to stand. XFIP, which is the it's a stat that takes the fielding independent numbers and normalizes the home run to fly ball ratio there. He's pitching about 4.50 XFIP, which it's about middle of the pack. We should probably see Galarraga settle down at some point here. But you mentioned Ian Kennedy in the up and down. Please continue.
Yeah, Kennedy and Hudson have both been, shown the ability to have, really great starts, alternated almost with really terrible ones. Like, Kennedy, for example, just a little bit earlier, at the start of the week, shut out the Phillies, pitched a complete game shutout against the Phillies, again in Chase Field, struck out 10, like a three-hitter. It's one of the best games, in fact, pitched by a Diamondback probably since the days of Johnson and Schilling. It was just, a thoroughly dominant performance, but then, a couple of weeks before that against St. Louis, he pitched three innings and allowed 9 earned runs. So that's the thing. When they're on their day, Kennedy and Hudson can certainly, shut down almost any lineup in the league. But they haven't got that necessarily consistency yet. Although they're both young pitchers, so it is probably something that will come with a little bit more experience.
Looking ahead to the series that we're going to play this next week, they haven't announced a pitcher for the third game. So far, it looks like from your schedule you would be able to skip Galarraga and throw Kennedy on Thursday. Do you have any idea if that's a likelihood or if we're going to be seeing Galarraga instead?
At the moment, the team hasn't done much in the way of skipping. There was a similar possibility was discussed after the first time we played you guys when the Sunday contest was postponed.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, we were heading off to Chicago. For a series there, and there was thoughts were being expressed as to whether we should be skipping the back end of the rotation, but in the end Gibson just went ahead and just continued to pitch them in their regular order. So on that basis, I would imagine that we're probably going to be doing the same thing here, but it really kind of depends on on how Galarraga performs. He performed fairly well last night, apart from the home runs. I mean, seven innings and three runs is not a bad outing. So I tend to think they probably will just go with him again.
Okay. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Greg. No. You. My question's my last question, so you finish your thought.
I was just going to break down the rotation for both teams over the coming series. We have Jorge De La Rosa versus Joe Saunders on Tuesday, Chacin versus Enright on Wednesday, and then we would either throw Jason Hamill or Esmil Rogers, depending on whether or not we choose to use that off day to skip our fifth starter against either Galarraga or Kennedy. So go ahead with your question.
Well, my final question, just before we let you go here, because we, like I said pre-show, we tend to push the limits a bit here, but the rest of the season, the mood for the Diamondbacks as a kind of the organizational feel, is it we're a spoiler role? Is it a keep your heads above water? Is it we're looking to sell during the season and kind of rebuild, or what are we looking at here in general, Jim?
Well, it's definitely going to be a rebuilding year. I mean, in terms of my hopes and expectations, I really just want to see the team going in the right direction. We've had the win totals have declined, since 2007 when we won 90 games. It's been, a steady decline to the 65 that we won last year. So I definitely want to see the team, turn the corner a little bit. I'm not expecting more than, maybe, mid-70s, 72, 73 wins. That's the sort of thing I would be looking for. I'm really hoping one of the focuses for the team this year should be the draft in June, because we've got two of the first seven picks, and it seems to be a very, very high talent draft. So it's important that the team, takes what's pretty much an unprecedented opportunity thanks to the Barrett-Lew compensation trade. We didn't sign our first round pick last year, so we got an extra first round pick this year, as I say, giving us two of the first seven. So I'm optimistic that we'll be able to take those picks and sign them and get the best players available and go forward from there. That's really going to be the key, I think, to the Diamondbacks season. I mean, as I say, I can't really see us, if you could even get back to 500, that would be a tremendous success for the team and give us a lot of hope going forward. I don't think we've got that much that we'd really be looking to trade away. Most of the players that we've got are either, young and we want to retain them, or they're old and aren't really going to pull an enormous amount of interest. Stephen Drew might be one possibility, as I say, with next year possibly being his last year with the club. Obviously, the sooner we trade him, then the more value he's likely to have. So that's something we might keep an eye out for. But otherwise, I think we'll be just looking to get the team back on track and heading up towards 500 again.
All right, Jim. Well, thanks for joining us today. You can, of course, read Jim's work at azsnakepit.com. We look forward to a good series, and hopefully we can do this again sometime.
That'd be perfect. I'll always enjoy talking to talking baseball, and we'll talk to you at some point, guys. Hopefully it will be a good series, and we'll both enjoy it.
Yep, we'll have four more during the rest of the year, so we'll see plenty of each other. All right.
Okay, well, you know where to find me, so certainly give us a call if you want to talk again.
Great. Take care.
Thanks very much, Jim.
No problem. Look forward to hearing it. Thanks, man.
All right, we're just going to close up real quick with one or two minor league notes. We don't talk about the minors too much on the show because, for one thing, there's not a whole lot we can say with any real insight because we're obviously not watching these games. All we really have are the box scores and whatever reports we get from the teams themselves. But I wanted to bring up Juan Nicasio because in a season where we have a lot of our top-of-the-line pitching prospects like Tyler Matzek and Christian Friedrich and Casey Weathers, who are all, having their early struggles. Josh Slotz as well lost his job to the temporarily inactive list. He might have to go back to short season for a little bit. But Juan Nicasio, who was a roster purchase from 2 years ago, he's been on the 40-man roster for a while. Kind of like Esmil Rogers, he's one of those Latin players who signed as a really young guy and has had to develop himself along with being on the 40-man because of Rule 5 stuff. So basically, he's one of those guys who's already on his clock, but He was obviously in Modesto last year, brought up to AA, and he's just been pretty incredible, so far. He's had 5 starts, and, in those 5 starts, I pulled up his stats here. Okay. He's pitched 28 and two-thirds innings. In that 28 and two-thirds innings, he has 40 strikeouts to 4 walks.
That's insanity.
Yes. Yes, it is. He's getting ground balls as well. I don't like to overhype players, but I do feel that everybody who's not paying attention to him should at least start. I tweeted just a couple minutes ago, which is rare for me because I never tweet anything, but I mentioned that, I wouldn't have expected at the beginning of the season where we have Nicasio and Christian Friedrich, who's repeating AA, I would have expected Friedrich to get the promotion first, but now I'm thinking that as the year goes on and we start to see some of the players get promoted, that Nicasio might be first in line for that AAA spot.
Nicasio, it's kind of surprising because we knew that he had a lot of talent and he was going to be not necessarily the guy, but one of those really intriguing figures to watch. He wasn't at the top of the top of everybody's prospect board because we didn't have the standard issue, Rocky's top prospect through Baseball America. He's definitely stepped up between last year, spring training this year, and a lot of the people who follow the farm more intimately have been bringing him to our attention. And, well, like you just said, 40 strikeouts to 4 walks, that's kind of sort of insane right there. I kind of question if we're going to see him in the majors this year. I'm more along the line of thinking that they'd bring back up Greg Reynolds, bring back up Clay Mortensen to
yes.
take a 6th starter role if needed, but you never know. I mean, sometimes young pitchers force the issue.
Franklin Morales in 2007, of course, would have been the guy who was making his way into a good season at AA, but wasn't really on the radar. But when we lose 3 of our 5 starters in the rotation, you've already got Greg Reynolds and Clay Mortensen in there. You just never know what's going to happen. So, now, regarding Matzek, you wanted to talk about his last start a little bit.
Oh, there's not much to say there. I mean, the point is he's had control issues all year, and people are wondering, is he broken? Is his delivery all wrong? Is they screwed him too much? I like to lean back and say, just because some pitching prospects make the majors in no time at all, and some hitting prospects make the majors in no time at all, Matzek just might take a while longer to get there. I don't think he's necessarily broken. Then again, I'm not also someone who is, you know, strong on scouting. I mean, just looking at his minor league performances, it looks like he has losses or a lot of his release. He has no command over his pitches, but his most recent start, he's able to make it out with only walking two guys over four or five innings, I believe, and, you know, it's still not great, but, I mean, the strikeout numbers are there still, and, you know, I'm hoping this is the kind of, you know, good things to come, that it was, he'll be able to build off this and, kind of restore some of the faith that a lot of the fans have in him as a prospect.
Yeah, I mean, it's, with a player like him, it's way too early to be writing anything off. And I know that one start looked really scary. I mean, any box score where you throw two innings and walk eight batters is not a very pleasant thing to read. But at the same time, you know, it seems like from our understanding that it's mostly control issues. The nice thing about control issues as opposed to like really serious body issues or arm issues is that at the very least, you can work on them. There's something tangible and identifiable that you can instruct him to do. And it, you know, if Matzek has to play 2 or 3 years in the minors of learning to pitch professionally, then it'll be disappointingly slow, but at the very least, it's not news like, you know, his arm is dead or something like that.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't encourage anybody listening who is worried about Matzek to be too concerned as of yet. And you know, just along with us, keep an eye on what he's able to do at Modesto and see where it goes from there. Anything else?
I thought I had on Matzek there, so I'm good to go for today.
Yep, we've both again Sunday nights. Andrew's got to write, and I have to edit this thing, so. I guess that's everything for this week. We should be back next Monday, the 9th of May. And, until then, on behalf of myself and Andrew, take care.